I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey there, I'm Rosemary Barton.
And I'm El Amin Abdul Mahmoud.
And this is Party Lines.
This week I want to talk about the RCMP watchdog report that just came out, which concluded the RCMP racially discriminated against the mother of Colton Bushi as they notified her of his death back in 2016. And I know we've had this conversation before, Rosie, about systemic racism and policing, but is change even possible within the RCMP?
Meanwhile, the Supreme Court is set to hand down a decision on carbon tax in this country the day we release this episode, in fact. The Conservative Party leader says the party needs a serious plan to fight climate change. So where does climate change fit into conservatism?
A whole bunch of things to get into, so let's go.
Let's go.
It's now been a few days since the CRCC, that's the Civilian Review and Complaints Commission, meant to be sort of this oversight for the RCMP. They released a report onto how the RCMP handled the aftermath of Colton Bushi's death. And just to remind listeners of who Colton Bushi is, he was a 22-year-old Indigenous man who was shot by a Saskatchewan farmer named Gerald Stanley after an altercation on Stanley's farm. Stanley ended up being charged with manslaughter and second-degree murder, and then he was acquitted in 2018. The reason we're talking about this today is that just after the trial, the CRCC started looking into how the RCMP treated Bushi's family. And the findings were just made public this week, and they're quite damning. Like, the CRCC's report says officers who showed up to tell Bush's mother that he was killed behaved in ways that were really quite awful. You know, they told her to get it together. Officers smelled her breath for alcohol. And in the wake of this report, I guess we're having this conversation again. We're finding ourselves having this conversation again about systemic racism. First, the RCMP commissioner said she accepts the report's findings. Then the prime minister said, you know, the way the RCMP treated Bushi's family is not acceptable. And it just, like, it all feels so familiar, you know? It's like a series of choreographed moves that we go through every news cycle of this, but then nothing really changes, and the injustices or the indignities or worse continue. So I'm wondering if we should call time, you know, on these familiar tropes that are just, like, they're not getting us anywhere. This way of having this conversation is just stuck in the mud.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it. And I think that when you are dealing with a relationship that is fundamentally about trust in one another, I don't know how you move forward when that trust seems to be broken again and again and again. As you say, the RCMP accepted all the recommendations in the report, but the commissioner who did the investigation also said this in the report, quote, the RCMP said very little about the issues at the heart of this case, and then said, it is a missed opportunity for the RCMP to take responsibility for the manner in which Mr. Bushi's family and friends were treated. Like, to me, when I read the report, that part really stood out, because it's one thing to say we acknowledge we made mistakes, we accept them, we will get better. There is now training, cultural training, that's going to be given to some of the officers involved, but to all of the RCMP members in Saskatchewan. But to also have the investigator of the Complaints Commission note that the RCMP never really acknowledged the fundamental problems that mm-hmm. happened in this instance, it seems to me like that's the first place you start, right? Instead of the last place you start. And I just, I'm deeply worried that that the force is not going to be able to get there. And I think that's a concern that a lot of people would have reading that.
Yeah, I think the force's ability to get there wherever there is has been, you know, repeatedly brought into question, not just in the last year, but over the last bunch of decades. Like, I don't know if governments or authorities think we forget or something, but like, let's just quickly connect the dots on a bunch of stories. So in late February, Julian Jones, who's a 28-year-old Indigenous man, was killed by the RCMP in Tofino, BC. He's from the same community as Chantal Moore, who was killed by a police officer during a wellness check last year in New Brunswick. There was Rodney Levi, of course. There was the video showing the assault on Chief Alan Adam. The stats are just staggering and consistent. Like, more than a third of people shot to death by the RCMP in the last decade were Indigenous people. And then you add on top of that this report, you know, from last month that APTN reported that the RCMP, along with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, were aware of violent protests being planned against the Indigenous lobster fishery in Nova Scotia, and according to the documents that they'd retrieved. And the RCMP didn't do anything to protect that fishery. So we, over and over again, hear the RCMP talking about working on anti-bias training, talking about working on anti-racism training. There are occasionally stories about how the anti-bias training courses that they've designed don't really address the specific institutional racism that is built into the force. This is a specific example that came up in the Toronto Star about a month ago. But this is all to say, we hear them over and over again saying they're working on reform. But at what point do we say, actually, this is beyond reform? Like, this is unreformable, because the CRCC report actually hinted as much, saying, yeah, we hear these recommendations, but we're just fundamentally not really sure if the culture of the RCMP can change. And so we're presented with a problem, which is that authorities keep constantly referring to this very gradual incremental change that they say will happen, and then repeated evidence over and over again that actually doesn't make much of a difference. And the frustrating thing for everyone following these stories is that we don't live in a vacuum. We can connect these stories. We can, you know, refer back to the last time that people in authority said something's going to change. And then once again, like, nothing changes, but we just hear the same canned language. And it really feels like a fork in the road.
It does. And yet, like, how many forks in the road do we have to have, yes, right? I mean, yeah, it was back in June of last year that a deputy commissioner in Alberta talked about how there was not systemic racism in policing in Canada. A couple days later, I sat down with the commissioner of the RCMP, Brenda Luckey, and asked her that question. And again, she was not able to recognize systemic racism in the RCMP, saying that she understood there were 15 or 20 definitions of systemic racism. A number of days later, though, she had to put out a press release saying that, in fact, she did. If that's the level of the conversation that we are having inside Canada's national police force, where it is almost impossible for systemic racism to even be recognized, how can we think that training classes are going to be what turns things around, to your point?
Right.
How many times do people of color in this country, how many times do they have to be faced with these forks in the road before something happens? You know, out of the Black Lives Matter movement came the defund the police movement, which you and I have talked about on this podcast before. Mm-hmm. But in fact, there are places where they've actually done this. When we were doing the research into this podcast, we talked about Camden, New Jersey, where a community in the United States which had super high rates of crime. And they decided in 2013, this isn't working. Like, our policing is not working here. So they decided to undo it. The police chief stayed on, but he gave the force a choice. He said, you can either be warriors or you can be guardians. But this is a police force that is going to focus on being guardians now. Many people quit. They left the police force. It changed the whole culture in terms of how they approached the community. Well, it hasn't been a whole success story. There have been problems, but the overall crime rate has dropped in that community because there was a recognition that were things that were so deeply flawed, so fundamentally and culturally flawed, that the only way to fix it was to completely change it. I'm not advocating for that here. That's not my job. But I do question whether another class about how you should behave and how you have to be aware of your unconscious bias is actually going to get us to the right place, you know?
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Camden comparison, because it really contrasts well with all of these, like, constant conversations we hear with the implicit bias training. Like, we're just going to have our officers go through another training. And we are sitting here pretending like the data isn't already in on implicit bias training. For example, there was an NYPD study that was released in 2020. The research suggests that, like, yeah, implicit bias training can be really helpful in the short term, but it doesn't have this sort of long-lasting effect that we think it does, and it doesn't really impact behavior as much as we think it will. So that is the Band-Aid solution that we hear most often, and it is already not working, at least according to the data that we have in. In 2016, the Harvard Business Review looked at the diversity programs and all these anti-bias trainings also, and they said that, yeah, people can be pretty reasonably easily taught to respond in the right way to a questionnaire, but then they forget the right answers when they're out there practicing it. So the question becomes, do you do the same thing even though it has not been working? Or do you at least try for a different model, like the one that you mentioned in Camden? Because we at least have evidence that so far it is working. And while it has problems, at least these are new problems that we could explore. That's like, this is interesting. This is a new place we haven't been. Instead of over and over and over again, being stuck in the same place, repeating the same sentiments.
Queer life in Montreal was wild.
Montreal in the 90s was a great time, but it had a dark side.
It was not a safe city for gay people back then.
But what else was behind a series of deaths in the city?
Somebody's killing gay men. We want to know why.
I'm Francis Poord, and this is The Village, The Montreal Murders. Get early access to episodes at cbc.ca/listen or by subscribing to the CBC True Crime Premium channel on Apple Podcasts.
I know we've been talking sort of all COVID all the time, but there is another crisis that continues to loom, Elamine, in case anyone has forgotten, and that is climate change.
That crisis.
That ongoing crisis. Two sort of parts of this have come to the fore this week, which sort of gives you an idea that maybe there's room for other things in the news cycle right now. One, as this podcast drops on Thursday, the Supreme Court will have ruled on whether the carbon tax put into place by the Liberal government in 2019 is constitutional. That was a challenge made by the provinces of Ontario, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, three provinces led by Conservative premiers. And it comes as we come off the heels of that Conservative convention last weekend, where Erin O'Toole gave a rousing part of his speech was about climate change and how it was no longer a possibility for the Conservatives to not have a credible, serious plan to fight climate change. And then just hours later, his party did not vote to accept a resolution that said climate change was real. So it was a bit of a pickle for him. But yes. It brings us to, I think, a bigger issue as we try and pull back on those two bits of news around climate change. And that is whether conservatives and conservatism can make climate change an issue that they can hold on to, grab hold of, and sell as a fundamental piece of conservatism. And it would seem to me that there probably is room for that. Let me play a clip of Erin O'Toole talking to our colleague Vashi Kapelis on Power and Politics on Monday. Here's what he had to say.
We will have a comprehensive plan before an election. We don't know when an election will come, but we're in the process of consulting people in the industry, experts. We're looking at some various policy options. We're taking the time to get this right because, as I said in my remarks, we cannot just hope that people will come around to views that we've had in the past. We have to make some key changes to earn the trust of more Canadians.
So that's where one conservative sits on it. What do you make of how that positions others?
Well, I think we have to start by the fact that, Erin O'Toole got in front of all conservatives and said, climate change is real. And the vote of the Conservative Convention said, okay, we are not willing to adopt this as a party policy position. That's not to say that the party doesn't recognize climate change is real. They just want to enshrine it into policy. So what do we do with this information? Because I think The curious thing is the conservatives are looking for a way to position themselves for the next election. I think an election that is largely going to be fought in the GTA. I'm sorry to the rest of the country, by the way. My apologies for saying that. It's just that if the conservatives have any hope at all of winning a majority or defeating Justin Trudeau, they're going to have to break up the fortress Toronto that the liberals have held. That means that they're going to have to position themselves as a party that, you know, recognizes that climate change is real, offers some kind of credible plan towards that. But politically speaking, if that is really potent for them to do, they haven't, at least so far, presented a credible policy to do that. And the question is, what policy mechanism are they going to pick? Is this a matter of realigning like environmentalism with what conservatism is right now? And there is no good reason, to my mind, that left of center parties should hold the dominance over the environment and the claim of saying we are going to do something about the environment. It tracks for me that conservatism is about, well, you know, conserving and living within your means. And maybe we can't live within our means the way that we are treating the environment right now. So like that is not inherently against conservative principles. Conservatives do favor markets. And look, at the end of the day, like if you institute a carbon tax, there's no good reason why that can't be in alignment with favoring markets. And so this is to say they just haven't found the policy mechanism by which to do it yet. And it is increasingly going to be a frustration for them because we got so much news out of this past weekend of this convention. And one of the biggest headlines for days and days after it was the Conservative Party doesn't know where it stands on the environment. And I think that is going to be embarrassing for them.
And it is not traditionally what many parts of the Conservative Party, the current form or the past forms, have even represented. You only have to look at former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney to see a progressive Conservative Prime Minister who was extremely proactive on the environment, whether it be the Ozone Accord in the late 80s, whether it be the Acid Rain Treaty in the early 90s, whether it be the creation of many national parks in this country under his government. In 2006, he was named the greenest prime minister of all prime ministers. Preston Manning, one of the founders of the Reform Party, which was one of the parties that was a precursor to the Conservative Party as we know it today, in recent years, talked about how conservatism is also about the environment, and said that pollution has to be paid for. He has made that statement very plainly. So there's actually more in the Conservative Party's history in this country anyway that speaks to a need to protect the environment. One of the places, or one of the reasons maybe why they got off track or lost along the way, maybe because as the Conservative Party's base started to recenter primarily in Western Canada, with a focus obviously on Alberta, it became difficult for the party to talk about the environment and to promote the oil sands and jobs in the oil sands. And I feel like that has somehow cornered them in a little bit on what they can do and say around climate change in this country. But the reality is that if we can move away from that and sort of depoliticize climate change, maybe we can get to a place where we're actually doing it better, because certainly this partisan approach isn't working. It's not bringing us faster to our targets under the Paris Agreement or anything else. And on that front, I would point to the United Kingdom, where they have managed to create cross-party support towards climate change. Back in 2008, they put in place the Climate Change Act. It was led by the Labour government, but the Conservatives have been for it in that country too. It sets emission reduction targets that they must comply with legally. And because that is now enshrined, it's a piece of legislation, you can fight over how to do it, but you can't fight over the fact that you're going to do it. And I wonder, at what point do we get to that place in this country?
And we should say that the Conservative Party, as far as we know, is still committed to those 2030 emissions reductions targets, but they just haven't presented us with a plan on how they plan to get there. And what's interesting in this case is that they have a bunch of opportunities, one of which is just to say, we're going to hold the government to account. So if the government wants to do this carbon tax plan, sure, but let's actually put it into motion and have a carbon tax that actually does something. Because so many experts right now recognize that the carbon tax that Trudeau so far introduced is not set at a place where it will change consumer behavior, or like really won't have much of an influence on consumer behavior. It's really just about introducing the idea. So it would be meaningful if the Conservatives said, okay, this is the plan that we're going to go with. Why don't we figure out a way to actually make it meaningful? And why don't we talk about getting rid of the subsidies that a bunch of corporations are getting right now? This would, of course, involve them, turning their back on the oil sector in a more significant way than they have before. But they do have a bunch of policy options at their disposal. The question becomes, which one does Aaron O'Toole go with? And one of the conversations we've had in the preparation for this podcast was that carbon taxes themselves are not the only way. Like, this is not the only way that Conservatives can kind of put together a plan. It's just a matter of actually deciding on something, because increasingly, the longer and longer it goes, the more time there is for the narrative to set in that we have a parties that are for doing something with the climate, and some parties who are not interested in it.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned the oil and gas sector, but the oil and gas sector in this country has also changed. It is now also far more progressive in its views on climate change than it was. There are major multi-billion dollar corporations actively doing things on climate change in a way that they haven't before. So there's room, I think, there to have that conversation for the Conservatives. Aaron O'Toole has suggested things like carbon offsets. He's suggested things like, instead of taxing individuals, taxing industries in a different way, or putting more regulations on places where it would have a bigger impact. Those are all, as you say, parts of a policy conversation that can and should be had. I think that the policy conversation becomes a little bit different if the Supreme Court says carbon pricing is okay and the federal government can go ahead and do it, because then what do the three provinces that contested the carbon price, what do they do with that? Do they put their own system in place? There's lots of questions. But I think what Aaron O'Toole has signaled is what a lot of conservatives believe, that the time for the Conservative Party to really embrace a plan to fight climate change has come, and it needs to happen. I actually just play that in the backyard now when I'm having a drink. Just play it and then have a little drink. Because
good.
I just,
does it help?
Yeah, it does help, but I'm not going anywhere because of the variants of concern. So I just play that in the backyard and have a little rosé. It's also the sound of Last Call, of course. Last week we asked, are you having tough conversations with friends and family about COVID-19 vaccines? We heard about Elamine and his mom. How are you addressing concerns or questions about vaccines with people you care about?
We heard from a bunch of people on this one. One person excitedly told us that they were literally driving their dad to his vaccine appointment in Quebec. I know, while listening to that episode, which is great. Another person wrote, thankfully, I'm not having any conversations about vaccine hesitancy. Everyone I know, including my parents who are in their 60s, is eager to be vaccinated ASAP. And someone from Manitoba tweeted, a relative who is a caregiver for another relative with health issues was concerned about them getting the AstraZeneca jab. Finding out our chief provincial public health officer, Dr. Brent Rusin, was getting it put minds at ease. This stuff matters. Which is true.
It's true. My parents got appointments, FYI, in 2 weeks.
Oh, my God. Congratulations. Yeah. That's so exciting.
Manitoba. Oh,
what a relief.
I know. Big time. Okay. This week, we want to know what you think about the RCMP, that story we were talking about there. We're asking you this. Do you feel the RCMP is able to tackle the problem of systemic racism in its ranks? You can tweet us. I'm at Rosie Barton.
And I'm at Elamine88. Throw in the hashtag. The hashtag is PartyLines. And let us know what you think.
And that is it for PartyLines this week. From CBC News and CBC Podcasts, I'm Rosemary Barton, chief political correspondent for CBC News.
And I'm Elamine Abdul Mahmoud. I'm a culture writer for BuzzFeed News.
See you back here next week.
See you next week, friend.
Okay.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.